Hi, folks. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. Today I'm remembering our comrade, now gone, Clayton Morgeridge. Both of us were over 30 years active in the Old Mole Collective, telling truth to power and reporting on struggles from below. We moles remember Clayton's many contributions to the mole as a host, a musician, a singer, an artist, an audio editor, the fellow who co-wrote our handbook. And we also remember the Clayton who always met his obligations, like the KABU, where everybody's expected to pitch in to do the grunt work, and Clayton did multiple shifts answering phones during membership drives. Finally, of course, we remember, and our listeners remember, Clayton's commentaries for the power of his critique of our current economic arrangements, that is, capitalism. These critiques always coupled with a reverence for ordinary folks, our neighbors on the planet, fellow humans, trying so hard and often succeeded in a world that forces people into individualistic defense, into competitiveness, to make sure your family stays above water, to fight for a precarious livelihood. Yet still, as Clayton points out, us ordinary folks are also struggling for meaningful lives, collaborating with others, showing empathy for others, experiencing and creating beauty. So first, in this remembrance of Clayton Morgeridge, we play his commentary entitled Capitalism as Organized Narcissism. It concludes in Clayton's words, "But most people, they are not narcissists at heart." One more thing, an announcement, that a memorial for Clayton is coming this Friday at 2 p.m., 326 Southwest Broadway, convenient by public transport. And now we hear Clayton.
I'm Clayton Morgeridge, and I'd like to tell you why I think capitalism is organized narcissism. Because capitalism has so many ways of making itself look good in the propaganda it distributes through the corporate media, advertising, and the education system which it dominates. Daily, we are shown the glossy and benign face of capital as providing all good things, from jobs to all our enticing consumer goods. So it takes a lot of effort to show the system in its true colors. Yet the underlying and terrible truth about capitalism is not hard to see if one just burrows a little way below the surface. Among the many charges against capitalism, it is a system of organized crime. It organizes the predatory activity of wealthy families and corporations and protects them from real and potential uprisings of the people they exploit. Capitalism is also, like much crime, psychopathic. In particular, it is organized narcissism. Here's a description of the psychopath by forensic psychologist Barbara Kerwin. Most psychopaths could pass as normal people, but more than most people, they are selfish, highly absorbed with securing the primitive comforts of life. They cannot delay their gratification or set aside their resentments. Though they may function in the world effectively, they do not conduct their lives according to accepted moral codes and standards of behavior. As intelligent as they may be, psychopaths lack an awareness that they are participating in the overall drama of the human species. Accused of a crime, they believe that the world that owes them a living has done them wrong. End of quote. According to Kerwin, psychopathy is not a mental disease or defect, but a global attitude of selfishness that governs a person's interactions with others. More than just selfish, psychopaths are narcissistic. Narcissism makes people dangerous because it deprives them of the restraint that results from empathy and respect for others. Narcissism permits them to ignore the humanity of their victims. It renders them insensitive to the act of killing. The notorious Ted Bundy was a psychopath, according to Kerwin, who interviewed him at length. Bundy raped and mutilated at least 30 women, felt no remorse, regretted only that he'd been caught, and bragged that he owned a girl like he owned a Porsche. But the narcissism of capital is not the result of narcissistic individuals, contrary to the capitalist propaganda that everything is down to the individual. The capitalist is not usually a narcissist by birth. To be a capitalist is first and foremost to have a certain role with certain powers and responsibilities, and living in this role leads one to be a narcissist, both in action and in one's heart. Examples of capitalist narcissism are not hard to find. The benefits of our corporate health insurance and long-term care insurance are sometimes hard to claim because the insurance companies would always rather delay than pay, especially if the claimants are likely to die before the benefits kick in. We now know how opioid manufacturers lied about the dangers of their drugs and made millions as millions died. ExxonMobil knew in the 1980s that burning carbon-based fuel was going to lead to climate catastrophe, but continued to pump, refine, and market it. Like Ted Bundy, they are unable to see or care about the harm they do. But for the corporation and the corporate executive, it's not because of something wrong with them psychologically, but because of this basic fact about capitalism. What gets done, what one must do in a capitalist society as a capitalist, is what profits the investor, and what does not profit the investor is not done. Of course, there are some accommodations capital must make with the public interest, but these are mostly window dressing, like the warning labels on cigarette packages. To the extent that we play this game and allow our social relations with others to be stripped down to the cash nexus and the quid pro quo, we live as narcissists among narcissists. It's a cold world, this world of organized crime, the world of the film noir, in which only the love interest provides a momentary respite from the Hobbesian state of war of all against all. But most people are not narcissists at heart. They do understand and respond to the experiences and situations of other people, even people who are far away. The ties between us are deeper than the cash nexus and the rule of law. We are bound by ties of affection based on empathy for the situations of other people. For the situations of other people are exactly what cannot be felt by the psychopathic narcissist. The enthusiastic capitalist, in pursuit of the profit margin, may love and empathize with members of his family and circle of friends, but to have these feelings towards those with whom he exchanges money and commodities is ruled out by the structure of his work. If such feelings arise, they must be squelched. A fully civilized society will be one in which ties of affection will extend freely to everyone we meet and to all those whose experiences we come to know about. Only then can we be cured of the social pathology of capitalistic narcissism. I'm Clayton Margaridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. To be me, then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give.
Hi folks, that was Nina Simone's I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. Clayton chose this song to conclude his next commentary on this remembrance of Clayton Margaridge. And this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, our Old Mole Variety Hour. In this segment, remembering the contributions of our longtime Old Mole, no longer with us, Clayton Margaridge. In the first commentary we just played, Capitalism as Organized Narcissism, Clayton's critique centered on how capital societies create narcissism and infects all of us. But then characteristically, he concludes, I quote, "People are not narcissists at heart. They do understand in response to the experiences and situations of other people, even people who are far away. The ties between us are deeper than the cash nexus and the rule of law. It's capitalist law he's referring to. And back to Clayton, we are bound by ties of affection. Clayton's second recent commentary that we'll play today, The Place of Art in the Green New Deal, also discusses how capitalism operates to impoverish the human spirit and soul. In this essay that deals with the sense of beauty and how capitalism operates to defile it, he also insists that us humans, all of us, seek the beautiful, we admire it, and most importantly, our fellow humans, even in the worst of circumstances, seek to create beauty as best they can. So Clayton suggests to us that in implementing the Green New Deal, that of course to end the cataclysmic threat of climate change and to make sure that we all across the planet can access the material like food, water, and shelter to sustain life, that we do all that as well as encourage and leave room for the creation of beauty by all of us.
Right now, I'd like to turn to another lesson we should learn from the original New Deal and demand from a Green New Deal, and that is massive support for artists and the works of artists and craftspeople. Now, one of the best places to learn about how an artistic sensibility guided New Deal projects is at Timberline Lodge here in Oregon on Mount Hood, where you can see how architecture, mural painting, weaving, furniture making, and carving were integrated into a public building. Thousands and thousands of similar projects were undertaken all across the country, where it was not just builders and engineers who planned and executed the work, but artists as well. As Wikipedia tells us, the Federal Art Project was a New Deal program to fund the visual arts in the United States. It established more than 100 community art centers throughout the country, researched and documented American design, commissioned a significant body of public art without restriction to content or subject matter, and sustained some 10,000 artists and craft workers during the Great Depression. End of quote. Well, the New Deal art project was put together by the federal government mainly in order to give work to unemployed artists. But there's another historical precedent which arose from an appreciation of the importance of art, not just the so-called fine arts, but every manner of creation that aims to be beautiful as well as useful. This precedent is the Paris Commune of 1871. As Kristen Ross describes the context of this in her book, Communal Luxury, The Political Imaginary of the Paris Commune, for 72 days in the spring of 1871, a worker-led insurrection transformed the city of Paris into an autonomous commune and set about improvising the free organization of its social life according to principles of association and cooperation. Ordinary people in a major European capital were exercising powers and capacities normally reserved for a ruling elite, until the commune was savagely put down by the state. But let's look at what the commune accomplished in the realm of art as a lesson for our Green New Deal. And I'll be quoting from Kristen Ross's book. The first thing that was done was to make artists and artistic production independent of the state, and of course of the patronage of wealthy elites. At a meeting of artists, the demand was made that artists be allowed to administer the arts themselves, that they assume control of museums and art collections. Some 400 artists attended the meeting, and they were not just painters and sculptors, but a rallying of all the different kinds of artistic intelligence together thought of as one. Architects, cabinet makers, and even shoemakers were thought of as artists, producers whose works were valued not merely for their utility, but for their beauty, for the pleasure they gave to the senses. Painters and sculptors were not to be making objects to be privately owned in the homes of the wealthy or placed in museums and galleries away from ordinary people. The demand that beauty flourish in spaces shared in common and not just in special privatized preserves means reconfiguring art to be fully integrated into everyday life and not just sequestered in special places called museums. art would no longer live this poor, thin life among a few exceptional men, as one communard put it. This liberation of art means eliminating the separation between what is useful and what is beautiful. It means treating beauty as an essential element of what makes something useful, whether it be a house, a piece of furniture, an office, or even a factory. What makes beauty so important that we should design society in a way that encourages the creation of beauty in everything we make? It is simply that beauty is part of what makes life good, not just living in beautiful surroundings, but also the ability to create what is beautiful. Many of the places we go to and go through are banal and dull. Think of most of Southeast 82nd Avenue here in Portland, or insides of many office buildings, or downright ugly things like slums, battlefields, jails and prisons, slaughterhouses, multi-lane highways. A world bereft of beauty is depressing and breeds resentment. As Marx points out, unlike other animals, human beings make things even when they have no immediate need for them, and indeed they truly produce only in freedom from such need. Human beings produce in accordance with the laws of beauty, says Marx. But capital is not human. From its point of view, the point of view of the investor, there is little or nothing to be gained by making beauty part of the world they build, aside from their corporate offices and private homes. Beauty is an invitation to love. A beautiful world is one we can love. In promoting a Green New Deal, we need to be inviting people to join in creating a beautiful world they can love, not just one capable of surviving the rigors of climate change. We say a better world is possible, but it will be possible only if people love the vision of that possible world. So the world the Green New Deal proposes has to be beautiful. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Clayton Morgridge, who passed on last month, but we still have about 150 commentaries he left us over the years, and also his wonderful book, Demystifying Demons, Rethinking Who and What We Are. Again, I should announce a memorial for Clayton is coming soon this Friday at 2 p.m. at 326 Southwest Broadway. Very convenient, by public transit a couple blocks south of Burnside. Burnside and Southwest Broadway. We'll end this remembrance of Clayton Morgridge with one of the anthems of the labor movement, We Want Bread and Roses Too. The song is associated with the Lawrence textile strike from January to March 1912. It united dozens of immigrant communities under the leadership of the industrial workers of the world and was led to a large extent by women. Yes, they did need bread. The roses, too. That signifies their striving for lives of some security from constant privation and fear, and for the time and opportunity to experience beauty and, of course, create it.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men. For they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our life shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses.